Now we play Russian roulette, yes?
He held the gun out and pressed the barrel against Bosch's left temple. Bosch had confidence in the DEA saying they had tricked the weapon, but there was nothing like the barrel of a gun being pressed against the temple to make one contemplate fate. Bosch closed his eyes. The Russian pulled the trigger, and Bosch jerked at the sound of the metal snap. In that moment, he knew the two Russians were the pharmacy killers. He opened his eyes and looked directly at the man in front of him.
Ah, you are a lucky man, said the Russian.
He spun the gun cylinder again and laughed.
We try for two now, lucky man? Why were you looking in my window tonight?
No, please, it wasn't me. I don't even know where your window is. I just got here. I even had to ask where the bathrooms were. This time the Russian pressed the gun's muzzle to Bosch's forehead. His partner spoke to him in an urgent tone. Bosch guessed that he was reminding the man with the gun of what the impact would be on pill production if Bosch was killed. The Russian withdrew the gun without pulling the trigger. He started reloading it. When he was finished, he snapped the barrel closed and pointed to the spot where the missing grip should be.
I will fix your gun and keep it, he said. I want your luck. Do you agree, really?
Sure, Bosch said. Keep it. The Russian reached behind his back and tucked the gun into his pants.
Thank you, really, he said. You go back to sleep now. No more peeping Tom shit.
Chapter 26. The Santos Air Fleet left the ground early Saturday after a morning distribution of pills, power bars, and burritos. Bosch was in a group on the same plane he had come in on, but this time the passenger count was higher, and there were more than a few new faces, men and women, on the plane's benches. He did see Brody, a stripe of purple bruising on the right side of his face, and the woman with the stars on her hand. They were both on the bench opposite him. Maybe it was the shaved head which gave the false impression that she was ill from something other than addiction, but Bosch felt a sympathetic need to watch over her. At the same time, he knew never to turn his back on Brody. This time Bosch was smart enough to muscle his way to a seat at the end of the bench near the jump door and the uncovered window. He'd now have a shot at tracking where the plane was going. They took off in a northerly direction and stayed on that course, the plane maintaining an altitude of only a few thousand feet. Looking over his shoulder and down through the glass, he could see the Salton Sea below. And then he saw the bright colors painted on the man-made monument known as Salvation Mountain. From high above, he saw the warning. Jesus is the way. Next, it was Joshua Tree National Park, and then the Mojave, the land below beautiful in its untouched darkness. They were in the air almost 2 hours before the plane landed hard on a strip used by crop dusters. As it made its final descent, Bosch had seen a wind farm in the distance set against hills dotted with cattle, and he knew where they were. In the Central Valley near Modesto, where Bosch had worked a case a few years before and had seen a helicopter hit one of the windmills and go down. There were two vans waiting, and the group was split up 7 and 7. Bosch was separated from both Brody and the woman with the stars. His van had two men from the organization in the front seats, a driver and a handler, both with Russian accents. They stopped first in Tulare, where they started working a series of mom-and-pop pharmacies for pills. At each stop, the handler gave each of the shills, including Bosch, a new ID, driver's license, and Medicare card, as well as prescriptions and cash for the copay. The ID cards were crudely manufactured fakes that any bouncer in his first week on the job would have alerted to in any club in L.A. But that didn't matter. The pharmacists, like Jose Esquivel Sr., were part of the game, profiting from the seemingly legitimate fulfillment of seemingly valid prescriptions. The ripple effects of the Santos corruption went on endlessly from there to the halls of the government and industry. Despite there seemingly being no need for him to pose as an injured man, Bosch kept up the pretense of wearing the knee brace and carrying the cane. He did it because he did not want to be separated from the cane, his only weapon. At each stop, the group spent close to an hour, the handler usually breaking the shills into singles and couples at each pharmacy so that 7 bedraggled addicts standing in line together would not cause concern among the legitimate customers in the store. From Tulare, they moved up into Modesto, and then Fresno, a steady supply of amber vials of pills going into the handler's backpack. The plane had moved and was waiting at another unrestricted airstrip outside a pecan farm in Fresno. The other van was already there, and when Bosch climbed on board, the spots on the benches in front of the windows were already taken. He did get a seat next to the woman with the stars. As previously instructed, he said nothing to her. Before the plane took off, Bosch saw the capper from his van hand his backpack through the cockpit window to the pilot. The pilot actually signed some sort of receipt or accounting statement on a clipboard and handed it to the capper. The plane then rumbled down the unpaved strip and took off to the south. They stayed on course without banking or taking any anti-surveillance measures. Bosch kept his counsel for a half hour before finally leaning toward the woman next to him and speaking in a voice just loud enough to be heard over the engine noise. "You were right," he said. "He came last night. I was ready." "I can tell," she said, referring to the bruise running the length of Brody's face. "Thank you."
"Forget it."
"How long have you been trapped in this?" She turned her body on the bench to literally give him the cold shoulder. Then, as if thinking better of it, she turned her head back to him and spoke.
"Just leave me alone."
"I thought maybe we could help each other out, that's all."
"What are you talking about? You just got here. You're not a woman. You don't know what it's like."
Bosch flashed on the image of the woman lying discarded on the couch while the Russians gambled for the pills that were the source of all this degradation and disaster. "I know," he said, "but I've seen enough to know this is like being a slave." She didn't respond and kept her shoulders turned to Bosch. "When I make a move, I'll let you know," he tried.
"Don't," she said. "You're just going to get yourself killed. I want nothing to do with it. I don't want to be saved, okay? Like I said from the beginning, leave me alone."
"Why'd you warn me about Brody if you want to be left alone?"
"Because he's an animal, and one doesn't have anything to do with the other."
"Got it." She tried to turn even further away from Bosch, but the lower edge of the pale yellow jacket she wore was trapped under his leg. The move pulled the jacket down over her shoulder, exposing the tank top below it and part of a tattoo. ISY-2009. She angrily jerked her jacket out from under his leg and back into place, but Bosch had seen enough to know it was part of an RIP tattoo on the back of her shoulder. She had lost someone important 8 years before, important enough to always carry the reminder. He wondered if it was that loss that ultimately put her on the plane. Bosch leaned away from her and caught Brody watching them from the bench on the other side of the plane. He gave Bosch a knowing smile, and Bosch realized he had made a mistake. Brody had recognized Bosch's attempt to connect to the woman. He would now realize that he could get to him through her. The plane landed an hour later with an easier glide pattern and touchdown. Bosch couldn't tell where they were until they climbed out of the jump door and recognized that he was inside the hangar at Whiteman. There were two vans waiting, and this time he tried to stick close to the woman with the stars. When the group was split, he ended up in a van with her, as well as Brody. From Whiteman, the van turned right on San Fernando Road, but then took Van Nuys Boulevard to the first pharmacy stop. They were in Pacoima, and apparently staying clear of San Fernando. The driver, who was the same Russian who had punched Bosch while in the clinic the day before, broke his seven chills into two groups and sent Bosch and two others into the pharmacy first. Brody and the woman with the stars were left in the second group. Bosch went through the process of providing a prescription and bogus ID to the pharmacist and then waited for the pills to be put into the bottle. In most of the previous stops, the pills were already bottled and ready, the pharmacist wanting to limit the time the shills spent in the drugstore. But in this store, Bosch was told to either wait outside or come back in 30 minutes. Bosch went outside and told the Russian. He was not happy. He told Bosch and the two other shills to go back and wait inside the drugstore in order to hurry the pharmacist along. Bosch did as instructed and was milling about in the foot care aisle within full view of the pharmacist when he turned around and saw another shopper looking at the Dr. Scholl's insole cushions. It was Bella Lourdes. She spoke in a low voice without looking at Bosch.
How you doing, Harry?
Bosch checked the location of the other two shills before responding. They had separated, and one was looking in the Mexican apothecary aisle, and the other was maintaining a vigil at the prescription counter.
I'm good. What are you doing in here?
Needed to check. We lost contact with you last night. Didn't pick you up till you landed at Whiteman.
Are you shitting me?
Hovan said they were the eye in the sky. They lost the plane?
They did.
Hovan claimed upper atmospheric interference. Valdez hit the ceiling about it.
Where'd they take you?
Jerry Egger's intel was on the button. It's an encampment near Slab City, southeast of the Salton Sea.
And you're okay?
I am, but I almost wasn't. I think I met the two shooters. One of them played Russian roulette on me with that revolver the DEA gave me.
Jesus!
Yeah, lucky it was tricked out.
I'm sorry. Do you want out?
I give the word and we'll swarm this place and pull you out and make it look like a bust.
No, but I want you to do something else.
Where's Jerry?
He's out there watching.
We obviously freaked last night when they lost you. But now we're on you and won't drop the ball.
Bosch checked the shills again. They were not paying attention to him. He checked the front door of the drugstore and saw no sign of the Russian driver.
Okay, as soon as we get our scripts filled and are out of here, they're going to send in four more. A woman and three men.
Okay.
Have Jerry swing in on random enforcement and bust them for fraudulent IDs, prescriptions, the whole works.
All right, we can do that.
Why? The guy named Brody is causing me a problem. I need him gone. He's got a line of purple down the right side of his face. Bosch proffered the cane in explanation. And the woman? I want to get her into detox and rehab.
For the first time, Lourdes looked up from her shelf shopping and tried to get a read on him.
You sound sympathetic. Is this getting personal? You heard what the DEA undercover trainer said about that.
I've only been under 24 hours and I don't even know her name. It's not personal. I just saw some stuff down there in Slab City and I want her pulled out. Besides, the more people they're down, the more important I become. Maybe they'll think twice about playing Russian roulette with me again.
Okay, we'll do it. But that will pull a lot of us off the surveillance.
I'll make sure at least one car stays with you.
Doesn't matter. You can wait for us at Whiteman. We'll be going back for the plane.
Bosch heard the name that was on his phony ID called out by the pharmacist.
Gotta go.
What about tomorrow?
What about it?
It's Sunday. These mom and pop places are usually closed Sundays.
Then I guess I get a day off in Slab City. Tell them not to lose me this time.
You better believe I will. Take care of yourself.
Bosch pointed the cane toward the ceiling and twirled it like a musketeer brandishing a sword. He then limped toward the counter to get his pills. 20 minutes later, he was sitting in the back of the van, waiting for the second crew of shills to complete their pharmacy run. He watched Edgar and Hovan enter the pharmacy, and 15 minutes after that, with the van's driver getting restless and talking to himself in Russian, a pair of LAPD cruisers pulled up. The Russian cursed,
"Tovyu ma!"
He turned around in his seat and looked at the three men sitting in the back. He pointed at Bosch.
You go in and see. Find out what is going on in there.
Bosch slid off his seat and moved to the side door. He got out and crossed the parking lot to the pharmacy. He guessed he had been chosen by the driver because he had the cleanest clothes of those in the van. He walked in, saw the four shills lined up and in handcuffs by the pharmacy counter. The uniformed officers were checking their pockets. Bosch's entering had rung an overhead bell. The woman with the stars on her hand looked over her shoulder and saw Bosch. She widened her eyes and jutted her chin in the direction of the door. Bosch turned around and walked back out. Acting as though he had just seen a ghost, Bosch quickly legged it back to the van, dropping any gentleness about his knee. He jumped in through the side door. The cops got them. They're all in handcuffs.
Close the door! Close the door!
The van was moving before Bosch could pull the sliding door closed. The driver took an exit onto Van Nuys Boulevard and headed back toward Whiteman. He hit a speed dial on his phone and soon was yelling in Russian at someone at the other end of the line. Bosch looked through the back windows at the Plaza Shopping Center as it retreated in the distance. For all her fuck-offs and leave-me-alones, the woman with the stars on her hand had warned him about Brody and then about the bus going down. It made him believe that there was still something inside her, worth salvaging. Chapter 27. There was no calamitous wake-up call on Sunday morning. No one walked down the side of the bus, hitting it with a broomstick and yelling for everyone in the camp to get up. On Sunday, the camp slept late. Having not been able to sleep at all his first night in the camp, Bosch had succumbed to his exhaustion Saturday night and slept deeply, moving through murky dreams of tunnels. When he was roused by the Russian with the dyed blonde hair shaking his cot, he was completely disoriented and at first unsure of where he was and who the man looking down at him was. "Come," the Russian said. "Now." Bosch finally came to and realized that the guy was the one who spoke the least English and had hung back on Friday night when his partner had put a gun against Harry's head and pulled the trigger. In his mind, Bosch had labeled them Ivan and Igor, and this was Igor, the one who didn't normally speak. Bosch swung his legs off the cot and sat up. He rubbed his eyes, got his bearings, and started pulling on his work boots, wondering if they were going to fly off to hit pharmacies again, even though most of the non-chain stores were likely to be closed on Sunday, especially those in low-income Latino neighborhoods, where a reverence for the day of rest and religious reflection was strong. Igor was waiting for him, holding the front of his t-shirt up over his mouth and nose because of the stench in the bus. He pointed to the door. "Come, hoodie." At first, Bosch panicked, because he thought Igor had called him Harry, and that his cover had somehow been blown. But then he understood what had been said in the Russian's thick accent. "Okay, okay," he said. Bosch looked around and saw that he was the only one Igor had rousted. Everybody else in the bus was still dead to the world. "Where are we going?" he asked. Igor didn't respond. Before pulling on his left boot, Bosch reached to the floor and grabbed the knee brace. He pulled it up over his left calf for use later, and then put the other boot on. He tied his laces, grabbed his cane, and stood up, ready to go fill prescriptions, though he had a growing suspicion that wasn't the plan for the day. Igor pointed to the floor. "Backpack." "What?" "Bring backpack." "Why?" Igor turned and headed out of the bus without another word. Bosch grabbed the backpack and followed, stepping out of the bus into blinding sunlight. He kept asking questions, hoping for some hint of what awaited him. "Hey, what's going on?" he asked. There was no answer. "Hey, where's your pal with the English?" Bosch tried. "I want to talk to somebody." The Russian continued to ignore Bosch's words and just used his hands to signal him to keep following. They walked through the camp to the clearing where the vans had picked up the shill groups the morning before. There was a van waiting with an open side door. Igor pointed to the opening. "You'll go." "Yeah, I get it. Go where?" No answer. Bosch came to a stop and looked at him. "You go. I need to hit the head first." Bosch could tell the Russian didn't understand the slang. He pointed the cane toward the south side of the encampment and started walking that way. Igor grabbed him by the shoulders and roughly redirected him to the van. "No, you go." Igor shoved him hard toward the van, and Bosch almost dropped the cane while grabbing for the door frame. "Okay, okay, I'm going." He climbed onto the bench seat behind the driver. The Russian then climbed in, slid the door closed behind him, and took the bench behind Bosch. The van started moving, and soon enough Bosch could tell they were heading to the airstrip. He knew the man behind him did not have the language skills to answer questions, but Bosch's growing concern over what was happening left him unable to stop asking. He leaned forward to catch the driver's peripheral vision. "Hey, driver, what are we doing? Why am I the only one going to the plane?" The driver acted like he neither saw nor heard him. In less than 10 minutes, they were at the airstrip. The van pulled up to a plane with an already spinning prop. It wasn't the minivan Bosch had taken all of his previous flights on, but still clearly a jump plane that could carry several passengers. The other Russian, Ivan, was standing next to the open jump door, using the overhead wing to shade his face from the sun. Igor got up and opened the van door. He grabbed a handful of Bosch's shirt and yanked him toward the opening. "You'll go plane." "Yeah, I figured." Bosch nearly tumbled out of the van, but used his cane to keep upright. He immediately started walking toward Ivan. He carried the cane by the barrel, rather than walking as if he needed it. He wanted to dispense with any sign of weakness in front of the man he was about to confront.
"What's going on?" he demanded. "Why am I the only one going?"
"Because you go home," Ivan said.
"Now."
"What are you talking about? What home?"
"We take you back. We don't want you here."
"What? Why?"
"Just get on plane."
"Does your boss know this? I got you 400 pills yesterday. That's a lot of money. He's not going to like losing that."
"What, boss? Get on plane."
"All you guys do is say the same thing. Why? Why should I get on the plane?"
"Because we take you back. We don't want you."
Boss shook his head like he didn't get it. "I heard people talking. His name is Santos. Santos is not going to like it." Ivan smirked.
"Santos, long gone. I am boss. Get on plane."
Bosch stared at him for a moment, trying to get a read for a sign of truth. "Whatever. Then I want my money and pills. We had a deal." Ivan nodded and pulled a plastic bag from his pocket. It contained pills and currency, the outside bill 100. He shook it and handed it to Bosch.
"There. You're good. Get on plane."
Bosch climbed through the jump door and went to the back of the plane, as far from the door as he could get. He sat down on the bench that ran along the rear bulkhead and looked back. Both Ivan and Igor climbed on board and took seats on benches on either side of the plane at the front. They looked like they were guarding the exit. Bosch knew he was in trouble. Giving him the money was the tell. They could have easily gotten away with stiffing him, but giving him what he had earned was a move designed to put him at ease, to make him believe they were actually taking him home. Ivan knocked a fist on a small aluminum door that separated the cockpit from the passenger compartment, and the plane started to taxi to the head of the airstrip. Bosch thought of what Ivan had said about Santos, and saw where it made sense. The DEA had no current intel on the man who had set up this operation. Hovan said the last known photo they had was almost a year old. Santos and those loyal to him could have been taken out by the Russians, especially if they had gotten wind of the indictment and warrant for his arrest, making him a liability to the operation. This would also help explain why the operation seemed to be short on manpower and why the two apparent bosses were doing the wet work. Bosch realized that if Ivan and Igor were indeed the killers who had wiped out the pharmacy in San Fernando, then they had made the call themselves. The end of the case was right in front of him. The plane turned and positioned for a run down the airstrip. Bosch felt he knew how this ride was supposed to end for him. He put the cane across his thighs and pulled out his wallet, yanking it off the chain seemingly by accident. He hoped the pulse alert was delivered to the DEA team that supposedly was watching over him. Bosch made a show of taking the currency from the plastic bag and putting it into his wallet. He then put the wallet and the bag of pills into his pockets. The plane started moving down the runway, gathering momentum. Wind started blasting through the compartment. The Russians hadn't closed the jump door. Bosch pointed at the opening and yelled,
"You're going to close that?"
Ivan shook his head and gestured toward the opening.
"No door,"
he yelled back. Bosch hadn't noticed that before. The plane took off. It rose steeply, and Bosch was pushed back against the rear wall of the passenger compartment. Almost immediately, the craft started to bank left, while still in its climb. It then leveled and was on a course west. Bosch knew that would take them over the center of the Salton Sea. Chapter 28. The unseen pilot throttled back once the plane leveled off. The engine whine lowered significantly, and that served as a signal to Ivan. He got up and started moving toward Bosch at the back of the plane. He had to hunch down to keep his head from hitting the curved ceiling. As he came forward, he reached into a front pocket and pulled out a phone. When he got to Bosch, he crouched on his haunches like a baseball catcher. He looked at Bosch, then at the screen of his phone, and then back at Bosch.
"You cop," he said.
It wasn't a question. It was a statement.
"What?"
Bosch said.
"What are you talking about?"
Ivan referred to his phone again. Over his shoulder, Bosch could see Igor still in his seat watching.
"Harvey," Bush, Ivan said.
You cop. I don't know what you're talking about, Bosch said. I'm not...
San Fernando PD. It says so.
What says so?
Ivan turned the phone so Bosch could see the screen. On it was a photo of a folded section of a newspaper. There was a photo of him that he could tell had been taken last week outside La Farmacia Familia on the day of the murders. It was the continuation page of a story, but not a story on the pharmacy murders. The headline across the body of the story continuation and his photo told Bosch all he needed to know. DNA clears death row inmate. DA moves to vacate conviction. Somebody had leaked the story to the Times. Kennedy. He had gotten word that Bosch and Holler were going to make a move in the Borders hearing and had acted to push Holler back on his heels and vilify Bosch. The story had included his current employment, and the photo of him outside the pharmacy had been a big glaring tip-off to the Russians. Ivan lowered the phone and put it back in his pocket. A crooked smile formed on his lips as he grabbed hold of the barrel of Bosch's cane, and they struggled for control of it. Ivan reached his free hand behind him and pulled a gun from under his shirt. With his other hand, he pushed the barrel of the cane in on Bosch and leaned into him.
Get up, cop, he said. You're going to jump now. Maybe you'll find your friend Santos, yeah?
Bosch checked the gun. It was a chrome-plated automatic, not the disabled revolver the DEA had planted in Bosch's backpack and that Ivan had brandished on Friday night. He riffed off the Russian's last words, hoping to distract him. You killed Santos, didn't you? You killed him and took over. And that boy in the pharmacy, you killed him and his father.
That boy was punk. He did not listen to his father, and the father could not control the son. They got what they deserved.
Ivan tilted his head back toward Igor, as if to acknowledge their work on eliminating the problem of Jose Esquivel Jr. For a split second, his attention was divided, and that was all the time Bosch needed. He twisted his wrist and turned the curved handle of the cane. He heard the release snick, and in one motion, pulled the handle and stiletto free, then drove the point into Ivan's right side with an upward thrust. The thin, sharp blade punctured the skin and went through the ribs and deep into the Russian's chest. Ivan's eyes widened, and his mouth formed a silent O. The two men stared at each other for a second that seemed to last a minute. Then Ivan dropped the gun to clutch at the stiletto's handle. But blood had already spilled over the weapon and Bosch's hand. The surfaces were too slippery for Ivan to find purchase. He brought his left hand up and grabbed Bosch's throat, but he was weakening, and it was the desperate move of a dying man. Bosch looked past Ivan to Igor, who was still seated at the front. He was smiling because he had not seen the blood yet and thought that his partner was sadistically choking Bosch out before throwing him from the plane. Bosch had killed men face to face before, as a young man in the tunnels back in Vietnam. He knew what he needed to do to finish the job. He pulled back on the stiletto and went in again, two quick thrusts up into the neck and near the armpit, where he knew major arteries waited. He then pushed the Russian back. As Ivan fell to the floor dying, Bosch grabbed the gun. He stood up, the stiletto dripping blood in his left hand, the gun in his right. He started moving up the plane toward Igor. Igor rose from his seat, ready for battle. Then his eyes fell to the pistol. He made a stutter move, first to one side, then the other, as if his body were moving ahead of his mind and seeking escape. Then inexplicably, he lunged to his left and went through the jump door. Bosch held still for a moment, stunned by the move, then quickly went up to the door, dropping the stiletto and grabbing the steel handle that skydivers hold before stepping out onto the jump platform. He leaned out. They were flying over the Salton Sea at about 200 feet. Bosch guessed that they had flown low to cut down on the chance that someone might witness Bosch's drop from the plane. Bosch leaned further out to look down on the water behind the plane. The sun's reflection off the surface was almost blinding, and he could see no sign of Igor. If he had survived the jump, he was miles from shore. Bosch went to the cockpit door and rapped hard on it with a pistol. He figured the pilot took it as a signal that the disposal of Bosch had been completed. The plane throttled up and started to climb. He then tried the door and found it locked. He grabbed on the overhead handles for leverage and kicked his heel into the door, bending it on its frame enough that the lock snapped loose. He quickly flung the door open and thrust himself through the narrow opening, leading with a gun. "What the fuck?" the pilot yelled. He then did a double take when he saw that it was Bosch and not one of the Russians.
"Oh, hey, wait! What's going on?" he yelped.
Bosch dropped into the empty co-pilot seat. He reached over and put the muzzle of the gun against the pilot's temple. "What's going on is, I'm a police officer, and you're going to do exactly what I tell you to do," he said. "You understand me?" The pilot was late 60s and white, with gin blossoms across his nose. A pilot no one else would hire. "Yes, sir, no problem," he said. "Whatever you say." His English was unaccented. He was likely native-born American. Bosch took a chance, noting the man's age and the blurred tattoos on his arms. "You remember the A-6 from Vietnam?" he asked. "I sure do," the pilot said. "The Intruder. Great plane." "I flew him back then and haven't flown since. But you make one wrong move, and I'll put a bullet in your head and have to learn to fly all over again." Bosch had never flown a plane before, let alone an intruder. But he needed a believable threat to keep the pilot in line. "No problem, sir," the pilot said. "Just tell me where you want to go. I don't have any idea what was going on back there. I just fly the plane. They tell me where." "Save it," Bosch said. "How much fuel do we have?" "I tapped it this morning. We're full." "What's the range?" 300 miles, easy." "Okay, take me back to L.A., up to Whiteman." "Not a problem." The pilot started going through maneuvers to change course. Bosch saw the radio mic hooked to the instrument panel. He grabbed it. "This on?" "Yes, press the button on the side to transmit." Bosch found the transmit button and then hesitated, unsure what to say. "Hello, any airport tower that can read this. Come back." Bosch looked at the pilot, wondering if he had just revealed that he had never flown a plane before. The radio saved him. "This is Imperial County Airport. Go ahead." "My name is Harry Bosch. I'm a detective with the San Fernando Police Department. I'm flying in a plane after an in-air event, leaving one passenger dead and one missing over the Salton Sea. Requesting radio contact be made with Agent Hovan of the DEA. I can give a number when you are ready to copy." Bosch clicked off and waited for the response. He felt the tensions that had gripped him for nearly 48 hours start to slacken off as the plane headed north towards safety and home. From 2,000 feet up, the land below looked beautiful to Bosch, and nothing like the Badlands he knew it to be. Chapter 29. Bosch got a crowded reception from state, local, and federal authorities when the plane landed under DEA air escort at Whiteman Airport. There were DEA agents, Jerry Edgar with a team from the State Medical Board, and Chief Valdez, and the investigators from San Fernando standing front and center. There was also a coroner's van and death team, a pair of LAPD detectives from Foothill Division, their own forensic tech, and a pair of paramedics just in case Bosch required medical attention. The plane was directed into an empty hangar so that it could be processed as a crime scene without media or public scrutiny. Bosch squeezed through the cockpit door and into the passenger section, and the pilot followed. He told the pilot to climb through the jump door with his hands up. As he did so, Bosch stepped to the back of the compartment. He took a long look at the man he had killed, his body lying still on the floor of the plane. Blood had run from the body in crisscross patterns as the plane had banked and changed altitude during the flight. Bosch moved back up to the jump door and exited the plane. Two men in black tactical pants and shirts, their sidearms held down by their sides, helped him off the jump platform. "DEA?" Bosch asked. "Yes, sir," said one agent. "We're going to go in and clear the plane now. Is there anyone else inside?"
"Nobody alive."
"Okay, sir. There are some people here who want to talk to you now."
"And I want to talk to them."
Bosch stepped away from the plane's wing, and Bella Lourdes was there waiting for him.
"Harry, you all right?"
"Better than the guy in the plane. How are we handling the debrief?"
"The DEA has a mobile command post. You're supposed to go in there with us. The LAPD, Edgar, and Hovan. You ready, or you want to?"
"I'm ready. Let's get this over with. But I want to see the LA Times first. That story today almost got me killed."
We have it for you.
Talk about bad timing.
She led him to a huddle with Valdez, Sisto, Luzon, and Trevino. The chief clapped him on the upper arm and said he had done good. There was an awkwardness about the greeting, considering what Bosch had been through, and it was the first indication that the Times story was going to be difficult to deal with. Bosch pressed on with the case at hand.
Our case is closed, he said. The dead guy in the plane was one of the shooters. The other one jumped out. I don't think he made it.
The frickin' guy just jumped out of the plane, Sisto said.
He said it in a tone that implied he thought otherwise, like maybe the Russian had help jumping. Bosch held his eyes with a stare.
Crazy Russians, Sisto said.
Just saying.
Let's wait on all of that until we sit down with everybody, Valdez said.
Bella, you take Harry to the debriefing. I'll get the paper.
Harry, you hungry?
Starving.
I'll have somebody get you something and bring it in.
Bella had walked Bosch halfway through the hangar when they encountered Edgar. He smiled at Bosch as he approached.
Partner, you made it, he said. Can't wait to hear the rundown. Sounds like a close fucking call.
Bosch nodded.
You know what, he said? If you hadn't told me that rumor about people going up in the plane and not coming back, I might not be here right now, partner. That gave me the edge on these guys.
Well, I'm glad I did something, Edgar said.
The mobile command post was an unmarked RV that had probably been seized in a drug case, then gutted on the inside and re-equipped. Bosch and Lourdes stepped into what looked like a mini board of directors meeting room. There was a separation wall with a door that led to an electronics nest. Agent Hovan stepped out of the nest, shook Bosch's hand and welcomed him back.
Anything on the second Russian? Bosch asked.
Bosch had reported on Igor's jump without a parachute while on the plane flying toward Whiteman. The DEA had dispatched a rescue effort.
Nothing, Hovan said. It's a long shot.
Hovan instructed Bosch to sit at one end of the table, so he would be visible to all who would gather for the briefing. Lourdes took the seat to his right, and the rest of the SFPD team took the chairs down that side of the table. Valdez came in and dropped the A section of the Times on the table in front of Bosch, and then sat down. The story had been a front-page lead, its headline a kick to Bosch's gut. He tried to read it as agents and officers started to file into the command post and take seats. DA cites DNA. Police misconduct. Will vacate death penalty. By David Ramsey, Times staff writer. A man sentenced to death for a 1987 rape and murder of a Toluca Lake actress may walk free as early as Wednesday when prosecutors cite new DNA evidence and misconduct on the part of the Los Angeles police and ask a judge to vacate the conviction. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office has requested the Superior Court hearing in the case of Preston Borders, who has been in prison since his arrest almost 30 years ago. Borders had exhausted all appeals in the case and was languishing on death row at San Quentin until the DA's newly created Conviction Integrity Unit decided to review his claims that he was framed for the murder of Danielle Schuyler. Schuyler was found raped and murdered in her apartment in Toluca Lake. Borders was an acquaintance who had previously dated her and was tied to the crime when jewelry, allegedly taken from the victim during the assault, was found hidden in his apartment. In a case built entirely on circumstantial evidence, Borders was convicted after a one-week trial and later sentenced to death. Deputy DA Alex Kennedy said that recently completed DNA analysis on the victim's clothing revealed a match between a small amount of bodily fluid found on the clothing and a serial rapist named Lucas John Ulmer, who was known to be operating in Los Angeles at the time. Ulmer was later convicted of sexual assault in several other unrelated cases and died in prison in 2015. Kennedy said investigators now believe that it was Ulmer who murdered Schuyler, and may also have been responsible for two other murders of young women that police initially suspected Borders of, but never filed charges on.
We think it was Ulmer who stalked and murdered her, entering through a balcony door that had been left unlocked, Kennedy said. He was a serial offender who stalked victims in that area.
Court documents obtained by the Times reveal that Borders and his attorney, Lance Cronin, have claimed that the jewelry found in Borders' apartment was planted there by a detective who was the lead investigator on the case.
This has been a gross miscarriage of justice, Cronin said. Mr. Borders has lost more than half of his life because of this.
Cronin and court documents identify the two detectives who conducted the search of the apartment and reported finding the piece of jewelry in a secret compartment as Hieronymus Harry Bosch and Francis Sheehan. The Times has learned that Sheehan is deceased and Bosch retired from the LAPD 3 years ago. Bosch testified during the trial in 1988 that he found the jewelry, described as a seahorse pennant, hidden in the false bottom of a bookshelf during the search of Borders' apartment. Borders, an actor who knew Skyler from auditions and workshops, was arrested shortly after the discovery. Bosch could not be reached for comment for this story. He was well known as an LAPD detective for more than 3 decades and was involved in many high-profile investigations. He now works as a volunteer detective for the San Fernando Police Department. Last week, he was involved in the investigation of 2 pharmacists who were murdered during a suspected robbery at a drugstore in the main shopping area of the small town in the San Fernando Valley. The story jumped inside from there, but Bosch had read enough and was not inclined to unfold the section to the page with his photograph. He was aware that everyone crowded into the room now was watching him and knew what the newspaper report said about him. He put the paper down on the floor next to his chair. It had no doubt been a hit piece orchestrated by either Cronin or Kennedy. There was no mention, before the jump at least, of an opposing view of Borders' innocence. No mention that Mickey Haller had by now hopefully filed a motion seeking to stop the DA's action. Bosch looked up at the faces lining both sides of the table. Opposite him at the other end was Hovan, and next to him was Joe Smith, his UC trainer. "Okay, 2 things before we start," Bosch said. "I haven't had a shower since Wednesday, and I apologize for that. If you think it's funky from where you're sitting, just be glad you're not where I am. The other thing is that the story today in the Times is complete bullshit. I planted no evidence in that or any other case, and Preston Borders will never walk free. You can check back after the hearing Wednesday, and the Times will be running a story that says so." Bosch checked the faces in the room. There were a few nods of approval, but for the most part, the investigators in the room gave no indication whether they believed him or not. It was what he had expected. "Okay, then," he said. "The sooner we get to this, the sooner I get to a shower. How do you want to start?" He looked down the length of the table to Hovan. It was his agency's RV. Bosch figured that made him the man in charge. "We'll have questions, but I think you can start anywhere you want," Hovan said. "Why don't you give us the headlines and go from there?" Bosch nodded. "Well, the big headline is that there is no Santos anymore," he said. "The Russians threw him out of a plane into the Salton Sea. One of them told me that right before they were going to do the same to me." "Why would he tell you that?" asked an agent Bosch didn't know. "Russians don't usually break so easy." "He didn't break," Bosch said. "He was about to kill me. He had the upper hand and wanted to gloat, I guess. He also indicated that he and his partner, the one who jumped, killed the father and son in the pharmacy Monday."
"Indicated?" Lourdes said.
"Yes, indicated," Bosch said. "I asked him straight out if they had killed the father and son. He didn't deny it. He said that they got what they deserved. He was smiling when he said it. But soon after that, things changed, and I got the upper hand. That's when I killed him." Chapter 30. They kept him for 3 hours in the mobile command post, at least half of the time spent going into great detail about what had happened that morning on the plane. All parties except for Edgar, the medical board investigator, had stakes in the death investigation and had questions to cover. Because the actual killing of the Russian occurred in the air over the Salton Sea, it became a jurisdictional dilemma. It was agreed that the National Transportation Safety Board would be apprised of the death, but the LAPD would handle the lead, because the plane with a body on board touched land at Whiteman Airport in the city of Los Angeles. The session in the command post was followed by a 2-hour walkthrough in the constricted confines of the plane, during which Bosch tried to show the investigators what he had been talking about for the previous 3 hours. It was agreed at the end that Bosch would make himself available later in the week for follow-up questions from all agencies. He was released at about the same time as the body of the Russian he had referred to as Ivan was removed from the plane and transported to the medical examiner's office for autopsy. Meanwhile, he was told the DEA was putting together a raid team to hit the encampment near Slab City and gather up the remaining players in the drug operation. It was decided that a media blackout would be kept tight on the case until that raid had concluded. Bosch was given a ride back to the SFPD station by Lourdes. He had left his Jeep there, as well as his real ID and cell phone. She also had to collect his bloody clothes as evidence in the use of the deadly force investigation. He lowered the window as they drove because he couldn't stand his own stink. "You going to talk to Mrs. Esquivel about all of this?" he asked. "I think we should wait until we get the all-clear from the DEA," Lourdes said. "You want to go with me?" "Nah, she'll be more comfortable with you and speaking Spanish. It's your case." "Yeah, but you cleared it." "I won't feel certain of that until they find Igor." "Right. Well, more salt, more buoyancy. They'll find him one way or the other." She knew who both Ivan and Igor were from the debriefing. Assigning names to the various principals had made it easier to tell the story. But the truth was, no one knew the real names of any of the individuals. Bosch thought about that, and remembered the woman with the stars on her hand. Another person he didn't have a real name for. What happened with the woman Edgar and Hovan popped at the pharmacy on Saturday? She got booked and sent to Van Nuys? The SFPD's jail was not used for holding female arrestees. They were transported to the Van Nuys jail, which was operated by the LAPD and had a female ward as well as a detox center. Did you happen to get her name?
Yeah, I did. It was... what was it? Elizabeth something, Clayburg or Clayton.
One of those. I'll remember in a sec. Was she cooperative?
You mean like, was she thanking us for pulling her out of the virtual slavery you described in the debrief?
No, Harry, she didn't mention it. She was pretty pissed off, in fact, that she was under arrest and not going to be able to get her next fix in jail.
You don't sound like you have a lot of sympathy.
I do to an extent. I've dealt with addicts all my life, including in my own family. And it's hard to balance sympathy for them with the damage they do to their families and others.
Bosch nodded. She had a point. But he could tell she was also upset about something else.
You think I planted evidence in that case 30 years ago?
What? Why are you bringing that up?
Because I can tell I've got people upset all around me. If it's that case, then you don't have to worry. The paper makes it look bad, I know. But it's not going to stick. It's a frame.
You're being framed.
The skepticism in her voice began to offend Bosch, but he tried to keep it in check.
That's right, and it will all come out at the hearing, he said.
Good, I hope so. They got to the station and parked in the side lot. Bosch went into the new jail where he took off his clothes in front of the duty officer and dropped them all into a cardboard box. While the officer took the box out to Lourdes to process, Bosch went into the jail shower and stood under the lukewarm spray for 25 minutes, repeatedly using the jail's industrial-strength antibacterial soap on every part of his body. When he was clean and dry, he was given a pair of jail pants and a golf shirt left over from the department's annual fundraiser tournament. There had been blood on his shoes, so they had gone into the box as well, and were replaced with a pair of paper jail slippers. Bosch didn't care how he looked. He was clean and felt human again. He went to the detective bureau to get the key to his office in the old jail. He had left his car keys, phone, and real ID there. Lourdes was in the war room. She had spread butcher paper on the meeting and eating table and was taking photos of the individual pieces of Bosch's clothing before bagging each item individually in a plastic evidence bag.
"You cleaned up nice," she said. "Yeah, ready to take up golf for the cause," he said. "I'm sorry you got stuck with the nasty job."
A lot of blood.
Yeah, I went for his bleeders.
She looked up at him. Her face told him that she understood how close he had come to being killed.
So you still have the key I gave you to the old jail?
Yeah, in my top drawer. Are you taking off?
Yeah, I want to call my lawyer and my daughter, and then I want to sleep for about 20 hours.
We have follow-up on all this tomorrow.
Yeah, I was just kidding about the 20 hours. I just need to get some sleep.
Okay, then. I'll see you tomorrow, Harry.
Right. See you.
I'm glad you're okay.
Thanks, Bella. Bosch crossed the street, ducked through the public works yard, and entered the old jail. When he got to his makeshift desk, he saw that someone, probably Lourdes, had used the key to enter the cell and drop off a stamped letter addressed to him at the police department. Bosch decided to get to it later. He folded it and was about to put it in his back pocket when he realized that his jail pants had no pockets. He tucked it into the waistband, then gathered his things and headed back out, locking the doors behind him. His phone screen said he had 17 messages. He waited until he got on the freeway heading south, and then played them over the phone speaker as he drove.
Friday, 1:38 p.m.
Just wanted you to know that we are locked and loaded. Request to be heard, motion filed, salvos fired.
And word to the wise, my brother?
Be prepared. There could be some major pushback on this. Okay, later. Talk next week. Oh, and by the way, this is your attorney, and it's Friday afternoon. I know you're off doing secret cop stuff somewhere. Give a call if you need to over the weekend.
Friday, 3:16 p.m.
Harry, it's Lucy. Call me back. It's important.
Friday, 4:22 p.m.
Detective Bosch, Alex Kennedy. I need you to give me a call as soon as possible. Thank you.
Friday, 4:38 p.m.
Harry, Lucy again. What the fuck did you do? I was trying to watch out for you, and now you do this?
You just... Kennedy is out for blood now. Call me back.
Friday, 5:51 p.m.
Shit. Harry, this is your old partner. Remember me? I had your back and you had mine. Kennedy wants to blow you out of the water. I'm trying to contain this, but I'm not sure he's listening to me. You gotta call me back, and you have to tell me what you have. I want the truth just as much as you do.
Friday, 7:02 p.m.
Hello, Detective Bosch. This is David Ramsey at the Los Angeles Times. Sorry to call you on your personal line, but I am working on a story for this weekend about the Preston Borders case. I would love to have your response to some of the things that have come up in court documents. I'll be at this number all night. Thank you.
Saturday, 8:01 a.m.
You don't miss a trick, do you? I thought if I called from a strange number, you might pick up and talk to your old partner. I don't understand you, Harry, but my hands are tied now. The Times is running with this. Supposedly it's hitting the website today and in the paper tomorrow. I didn't want this, and if you had just talked to me, I think it could have been avoided. Just remember, I tried.
Saturday, 10:04 a.m.
Detective Bosch, this is David Ramsey from the Times again. I really want to get your side of things on this story. Court documents allege that you planted key evidence that tied Preston Borders to the murder of Danielle Schuyler in 1987. I really need you to respond to that. It's in documents filed by the DA's office, so it's fair game to report, but I would want your side of it. I'm at this number all day.
Saturday, 11:35 a.m.
Hey, Dad. Just wanted to say hi and see what you're up to this weekend. I was thinking of coming up today. Okay, love you.
Saturday, 2:12 p.m.
Dad, oh Dad, hello. This is your daughter, remember me? Are you there? My window for coming up is closing, call me back.
Saturday, 3:00 p.m.
David Ramsey again, we aren't holding the story any longer, Detective Bosch. I've been to your house. I've called all your numbers. No response. It's been almost 24 hours. If I don't hear back from you in the next couple of hours, then my editors say we go with the story without your response. We will, however, out of fairness, document our many efforts to reach you. Thank you. I hope you will call back.
Saturday, 7:49 p.m.
Holler here. Have you seen the fucking Times online? I knew there would be pushback, but this is beyond the pale. They didn't even call me. They make no mention of our petition or our side of it. This is what you call a hit job. This asshole Kennedy is trying to stack the deck. Well, he just poked the wrong fucking beehive. I'm going to eat his lunch. Call me, bro, so we can put our heads together on this.
Saturday, 9:58 p.m.
Dad, now I'm getting worried. You're not answering either phone, and I'm getting scared. I've called Uncle Mickey and Lucy, and both said they've been trying to get you, too. Mickey said you told him you were going off the grid. I don't know what's going on, but call me back. Please, Dad.
Sunday, 9:16 a.m.
Dad, I'm really scared. I'm coming up there.
Sunday, 11:11 a.m.
Call me as soon as you get this, my brother. We need an attorney-client meeting. I have a few ideas about how to bolster our case and go right at these fucks. Call me.
Sunday, 12:42 p.m.
Dad, I saw the paper and I know what's going on. Nothing is that bad. It doesn't mean a thing. You have to come home. Right now, I'm here. Come home.
Sunday, 2:13 p.m.
Call your attorney. I'm waiting.
Bosch was overcome by the emotion he heard in his daughter's voice. She was holding back tears, being strong for him. She thought the worst, that the professional humiliation and suspicion promulgated by the Times story had caused him to disappear, or worse. In that moment, he vowed to make those behind the story pay for their crime against his daughter. His first call was to her.
Dad, where are you?
I'm so sorry, baby. I haven't had my phone. I've been working and...
How could you not get all those messages? Oh, my God, I thought you were...
I don't know. I thought you did something.
No, they're wrong. The paper's wrong and the DA's wrong and your uncle and I are going to show it in court this week.
I promise you I did nothing wrong and no matter what, I would not do anything to myself. I wouldn't do that to you.
I know. I'm sorry. My mind just went crazy when I couldn't reach you.
I went undercover for a couple of days on a case and I...
What? You went undercover? That's crazy.
I didn't want to tell you ahead of time because you'd worry, but I didn't have my phone. I couldn't carry it. Anyway, where are you? Are you still at the house?
Yes, I'm here.
There was a business card in the front door from the reporter who wrote that story. Yeah, he was trying to call me, too. He got used. I'll deal with that later. I'm on my way home. Will you wait for me?
Of course, I'm here.
Okay, I gotta go and make some other calls. I'll be there in less than 30.
Okay, Dad. Love you.
Love you, too. Bosch disconnected. He took a deep breath and then hit the heel of his palm hard on the steering wheel. The sins of the father, he thought. His life and his world had once again clobbered his daughter. If he vowed to make those who did this pay, didn't that include himself? He called Holler back next.
Bosch, where you been, man?
Out of the loop, obviously. I was without a phone. And of course, the shit hit the fan.
I'll say. I think the whole thing is actionable. Careless, reckless, you name it.
You talking about the newspaper?
Yeah, the Times. Let's go at them. Defamation of character.
Forget it. That guy Ramsey was used. I want Kennedy and Cronin. Maddie couldn't reach me either. She thought I rolled up in a ball somewhere and killed myself. I know, she called me. I didn't know what to tell her.
You didn't tell me.
Cronin and Kennedy are going to pay for this. Somehow, some way. Wednesday, baby. We take them down Wednesday. I'm not so sure about relying on a judge to do the right thing.
Well, we got to meet. What are you doing right now?
I'm heading home, and I have to spend some time with my daughter.
Okay, call me. I'm free tonight if you want to get together. Otherwise, what's your schedule tomorrow?
I can meet in the morning.
Why don't we just do that? You take Maddie to dinner and we meet tomorrow. Dupar's at 8?
Which one?
You pick.
Holler lived just off the edge of Laurel Canyon, which put him within striking distance of the Dupar's locations in Studio City and the farmer's market in Hollywood. Let's do Studio City in case they need me up at the PD tomorrow morning for follow-ups. I'll be there. Listen, before you go, I got calls from you, Maddie, Kennedy, and the reporter. I also heard from Lucy Soto. Sounded to me like she saw the bullshit in what Kennedy was doing and isn't happy about it. I think she could be on our side on this. If we show her what we've got, we could have somebody on the inside working for us. There was silence.
You there, Holler? I'm here. I'm just